I mean, one could certainly say that at some point, no matter what your position is about the early years, I mean, you could say at some point there is historical solid narrative. That, I mean,
the red line is at Har Sinai. In my view, I mean, if you don't believe that that was a historical event, then the ground underneath our feet dissolves. Wouldn't you agree?
No, I understand. I agree. But that doesn't mean there's no historicity in something earlier. I mean, I'm assuming that the primary concern that you have is with the early generations and the length of years. So by the time you get to Yehuda, you know, those problems are not there anymore. So I'm very confident that from that point on, history poses no real problem.
You're going to speak well.
Okay. Hi, everybody. Good morning. Again, as I say every week, we will not automatically be going in detail pasuk by pasuk, but the first perek in particular, I wanted to cover a bit more thoroughly because it does set the tone for a lot of the book. Let me emphasize, however, that it is important to know, in case you're getting impatient for various reasons, it is important to know that the first 9 prakim of Mishlei, which will be very selective, are very, very different than the bulk of the Sefer, which is from Perek Yud to the end of the book. The first is more of an extended essay, which is really more general ideas of Yiras Hashem, and devoting your life to things that are important and not wasting your life. But it's a very, very general. The so-called term proverb, which are short, pithy sayings, that really starts from Perek Yud. So in many, many ways, the way the Mefarshim describe it, Aleph to Ches is a very long introduction. It's a long introduction. It's 9 prakim. But there are relatively few proverbs in that first section. There are some. In fact, one of the proverbs that we'll look at, not today, but I'll just mention it so you know that proverbs are coming down the pike, is the one of the famous proverbs that has entered the English language. Leich el namala atzel. Go to the ant, thou sluggard, as countless generations, going back to Puritan times, have learned. Learn from the ants how to be ants, not A-U-N-T, which I pronounce aunt anyway. That's the correct way of pronouncing it. But some people say ant. But ant over here means A-N-T. And Shlomo HaMelech calls upon us to observe the industriousness of the ant, how it gathers all the food during the summer to be able to eat during the winter. That is an example of a proverb that appears in the first part, but by and large, most of that which we call Mishlei is going to be in Perek Yud, right? So at this point, we're dealing with more extended discussions, which are a bit more amorphous because they are tied to the general idea of dedicating your life to serving Hashem and not frittering it away. Again, the theory behind the composition of the Sefer is fairly simple. We first have to lay a foundation of what is life about, and then we get into more specific teachings. Okay, so Mishlei as pithy proverbs will be coming down the road, but right now we're looking at more extended and more general ideas. Now, if you recall, the very first mashal that we looked at was basically a story discouraging your son, or our son, from following the ways of bad people who want to murder and steal and ambush. And although you might say, well, Baruch Hashem, except in rare cases, those are not the nisyonos that I face with my children. My child is not going to be a murderer, a thief, an ambusher, although unfortunately there are people who do face those challenges. But you understand, of course, that these are metaphors for doing things that are improper. In other words, the Mechaber is specifically using the extremities of hyperbole to illustrate the notion of not following the masses. Right? Al teilech b'derech itam. Do not follow them. and not even follow them to be observers, because even if you're not, actually you should know that Lahavdil, just to address the matter from a secular standpoint, I don't know Israeli law, but at least in American law, you know, you can, it's a very, very amazing thing. If you simply go along for the ride, literally, you go for the ride, and people rob a bank, and somebody gets killed, and you didn't have a gun, you can be tried for murder. That's called felony murder. And not only that, that's even if a policeman kills an innocent bystander, you, who didn't even have a gun, you can be tried for murder. So the truth of the matter is, that has real world consequences to simply tag along for the fun, but we're not talking about in Mishlei the legal consequences, we are talking about the spiritual consequences. And therefore the first mashal is directed to the Yetzer Hara that the Vilna Gaon describes as Kasani, which literally means anger, but anger refers to a whole bunch of related ideas, power, domination, control, because anger is really a reflection of a person's desire to control their environment, and therefore it refers to the not giving in to the demands of the ego, which in an extreme way can culminate in murder and the like. And the point that is made is that things that look attractive in the short term actually turn out to be destructive to you. And that was the mashal that was given about the bird that is clueless when the bird goes over to the trap to take all of the nice seeds that are scattered there. The bird doesn't realize that it is trapping itself in a pathway of destruction. And therefore it says, what is the pasuk end with that mashal? It ends at pasuk yutes. Kain or chos kol botseya botsa. This is the inevitable pathways of all those who engage in botseya botsa, is to appropriate things that are not theirs, to steal, to rob. Es nefesh ba'olav yikach. They take, or he will take, the soul of the owners. But the Mefarshim explained, the Gra explains, this doesn't just refer to the murder of the victim. He's murdering his own soul. Nefesh ba'alav yikach. That the harm that you do to others turns out to be the harm that you do to yourself. Right. So that is mashal number one. Not giving in to the kasani. Right? Kasani. And also, in a more general sense, not giving in to the peer pressure of others who are trying to make it sound like it's a good thing, it's not a big deal, etc. Okay, now the next mashal, which is a mashal, again, it's very interesting because this mashal appears three or four times in the first nine chapters, every time in a different way. Now again, it would seem from a perusal that it's almost as if Shlomo HaMelech had multiple drafts in which he wrote it one way, and then he wrote it another way. Part of, again, I don't know how to fit this in with a totally traditional understanding. One of the things that every person who learns Mishlei encounters is seeming repetition and redundancy, but often in a slightly stylistic variation. Now, one possibility is, everything does have differences, that Shlomo HaMelech wrote the Mishalim at different times, and they were then collected by the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, who canonized the book. And if we found different versions, all of which had Ruach HaKodesh, they were put together. This mashal in particular actually appears three or four times, but always with a little bit of a hosafa. We can just assume that Shlomo HaMelech himself taught it in different ways. The time, you know, it's interesting, just to, not that it's the same, but I see that, you know, Chabad, around 20 years ago, unearthed what's called, very, very, very interesting, and it's controversial whether they should have published it, they were debating themselves, a Mahadura Kama of the Tanya. What do I mean? The Tanya is the, what is called, by Chabad at least, the Torah Shebichsav of Chassidus. It is the written Torah of Chassidus. But apparently the Alter Rebbe had written an earlier version of the Tanya that was never published, never printed, and Chabad unearthed the Mahadura Kama, and they published it.
Of the Alter Rebbe?
The Alter Rebbe. No, the Alter Rebbe. The Alter Rebbe had written a prior version of the Tanya, and then he rewrote it, and then that was the one that was printed, but they unearthed in manuscript the first draft of the Tanya. So they were debating whether it's appropriate to publish the first draft of a holy book, because if the Alter Rebbe rewrote it, he wanted it to be that way, right? So why are you publishing the first draft? But they concluded at the end that you'll understand the second draft if you understand the first draft. But they did the same thing, by the way, with Mesilas Yesharim. I don't know if you've come across this. The Mesilas Yesharim, Ramchal, very relevant to Mishlei, one of the great Musar Svarim of ethical development. And it's based on Kabbalah, but it uses non-Kabbalistic terminology. We have the Mesilas Yesharim, but they unearthed the first draft that was written a totally different way. In the first draft, it was written as a dialogue between the neshama and the guf, the soul and the body. And it was written as a discussion, as a debate, in which he made all of his points. And then in the second draft, he decided to take out the dialogue and just write it as a straight Sefer Musar. We don't really know the thinking of the Ramchal. Why did he change his mind? Because he did write other Svarim exactly with the dialogue of the Neshama and the Guf, and Mesilat Yesharim was originally written exactly that way. So it is fascinating about the notion of first draft. I mean, they do it with novels too, which that's no big deal. They'll find a first draft of The Great Gatsby, and if you're a scholar or a literary theorist, it's very fascinating to trace, you know, why certain things were changed. But with Sifrei Kodesh, it's actually a live debate whether it's appropriate to take to find the Mahadura Kama, the first edition of a Gadol, since that was not the one that he wanted to have circulated. But nevertheless, they did it with Mesilas Yesharim, and they did it with Tanya. What I'm saying, which perhaps is a little more risque, is that perhaps the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah even did it with Mishlei, in which Shlomo HaMelech taught things in different ways over different times, and they put everything in so you will get the maximum understandings from each iteration of it. So the mashal that's given here is that a person is wandering, like the world is like a road in which you're wandering around and you don't know where to go. But there are voices that are beckoning you to go on a certain path. And often, and of course the voices here are personified as women. And there is the good woman and there is the bad woman. And there is the good woman that is calling you to holiness and mitzvos and yiras Hashem. And then there is the bad woman that is standing on the other side of the city, so to speak, on a mountaintop. They're all on high places saying, come to me, there'll be quick pleasures and enjoyments and the like. And the Mishalim paint in great detail the destructiveness of one side and the goodness of the other side. But initially, the mashal is only one woman, meaning to say, later in the book, we're going to have the two women. Here, we only talk about the good woman. And the Vilna Gaon points out, if we look at Pasuk Chaf, Chachmos. Now, Chachmos, there's already a grammatical problem here. Chachmos, what does it even mean? Does it mean wisdoms, plural? Does it mean wise women? We would normally say chachmaniyot. We would say it a little differently. But or chachamot, yeah, chachmot, right. Chachmot is wisdoms. Now, you'll notice, of course, as well, that the verb is a singular verb, tarona. Right? So there is a concept, the Mefarshim explain, that although there are many types of wisdoms that are good, but all wisdoms have a unity because they will bring you to the right place. Meaning, just as a person may come to Hashem through Hasidus or through Musar or through Halacha, different pathways. There is Chachmos. There are many pathways of good wisdom. But they're really one because Kol HaDrachim will be Movilin Otel. They'll bring the person to the right destination. That is why the Chachmos do have a singular verb. I'm sorry, did you have a question?
I just want to run on
Pasuk Chaf. Perek Aleph Pasuk Chaf. Now, The Vilna Gaon then makes the following point, that if you look at the first mashal that talked about the peer pressure to go and steal and go and kill, they keep on using words of secrecy. Let us wait in ambush. Let us hide. And he says, now of course, on a simple level, that's because if you want to commit crimes, you do so in a way that you're not going to be caught, right? Although there was a crazy, sometimes, I mean, they sometimes even have stories about how stupid thieves can sometimes be. There was a woman in the States who was very, very frustrated at the government not doing something for her. So she went and she robbed a bank. And she put a video on YouTube, you know, showing the money, saying, I have $5,000 here, and by the way, I also took a car. She showed up keys. So, of course, you know, the police just circulated the video asking if anybody knows her. And, of course, her former husband did know her. So, you know, so that's a little... Right, right. So that's a little bit of a shtus. But generally speaking, the thief will wait in the at night. And, right? But the Vilna Gaon says there's a deeper psychological insight. And that is, when we go off the derech, we have a sense of shame. We don't want people to know. Because in the depths of our heart, we know we're not doing the right thing. And therefore, even the Russia... Again, well, maybe the confirmed Russia, maybe at some point you get so far away that it no longer bothers you, but at least initially. In fact, the idea, you know, this is what they say with adolescents, sometimes when kids go off the derech or whatever it is, this is the concept of wanting to be caught, wanting to be yelled at, wanting to be told you're doing the wrong thing and we're going to move you back. So the Vilna Gaon, say again?
A cry for help.
That's a cry for help. So the Vilna Gaon says that it is the nature of when a Jewish person at least does bad things, there is a sense of shame, hiding. He doesn't want people to know. You know what the Gemara says? The Gemara says, interestingly enough, that when Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai was on his deathbed, the great Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, and his Talmidim asked him for a bracha, a word of wisdom, a musar. So the last musar he gave them is, may it be Hashem's will that you fear Hashem as much as you fear people. So they said, that's all you're telling us? He says, yeah, halavai. Because people do aveiros all the time and Hashem is watching. But you're not going to do it so people to see you. And that's why the Gemara says, by the way, you know, we have two types of robbers. We have a ganav, that is a burglar. He tries to steal when nobody catches him. He breaks into your house at night. And then we have a gazlan, that's an armed robber who comes in and robs you in open. Now, strangely enough, the halacha is, the Torah is stricter with a ganav, a burglar, than it is with a gazlan. If I am a burglar and I steal $100, the Torah says I have to pay kefil, I got to pay $200. If I robbed you at gunpoint, I only pay $100. Why is that so? We would think armed robbery is a worse crime. So the Talmud says, a beautiful thought. The Gemara says, the ganav is more afraid of people than God. He doesn't mind that God catches and sees him, but he doesn't want to be caught by people. The gazlan, at least, is neither afraid of God nor people, so he's not making people bigger than God, so he gets off with a lighter penalty. That's what the Gemara in Bava Kamma says. But the point that the Vilna Gaon says is that this notion of shame is associated with giving in to negative peer pressure. There is a notion of shame. As opposed to chachma, the chachma of Torah, bachutz, calls openly, publicly, nothing to hide, nothing to be embarrassed about. And that is why it contrasts it. The bad friends come to you and say, in hiding, in secret, nobody's around, surreptitious conversation. The claim of the Torah can be open. Right, the chachmas call out in an open way. Tarona, tarona means they sing. It's a singular. She sings. Berchavot titen kola. She calls out in the street, and then Barosh Hamio Tikra bePischei Sharim at the gates of the city. Amareha Somar. She calls out. Now the Gra will point out. You're going to see a very intricate weave here. That there's going to be a constant dance between the number 4 and the number 3. And the Vilna Gaon has a very, very complicated structure. He does point out that in this rhetorical description of wisdom calling you from the city, come to me, there are 4 expressions that are used. Chachmos bachutz torona, the chachmos sings outside. Birachavot titen kola, in the streets it gives its voice. Barosh hamiot, at the top of the high places, at the entrances of the gates. She calls tikra, and then in the city itself, amareh somar. So the Vilna Gaon offers several different explanations, many of which are not consistent. Again, you have to know that the commentary of the Gra and Mishlei was not written by the Gra himself. These were notes taken by Talmidim. And once again, the Gra himself gave different pshatim at different times. So you have to know that if you ever want to study this in the original, that the explanations are not always consistent, even though they're not indicated with Dover Acher. That's why it's confusing. When Rashi, for example, gives you different interpretations, he will tell you these are different interpretations. I've given you one interpretation, now I'm giving you another. In the Perish HaGra, one of the difficulties is that it'll be a continuous explanation, but in point of fact, the explanation is switching in the middle without a Dover Acher. That's going to be one difficulty. But the first explanation the Gra gives us here is that this refers to the 4 levels of Torah. Torah has 4 basic levels. Well, actually not 4 basic, but 4 levels, as we know, and that is encapsulated in the term pardes. Pardes means the orchard, the sacred orchard, and the pei is for peshat. I'll try to briefly explain what these are. The resh is for remez, the dalet is for derush, and the samach is for sod. But the relationship is actually not following the letters. Pshat and Jerush are connected, and Remez and Sod are connected. So really it should be Sod. So really it should be like that was a baseball team, the Padres. What is it? It shouldn't be Pardes, it should be Padres. But okay. And the way it works is the following. Pshat. Actually, it's not so pushy to know what's pshat. Somebody wrote a very cutely named article. What's the pshat of pshat? You know, it is not so pushy. But generally speaking, pshat is what the basic words communicate, looking at it grammatically and syntactically. Now that might be very deep. Grammatical understandings can itself be a very, very deep thing. But that is pshat. You look at the grammar, the dictum, the lashon, and you extract a message. Now, derush, which is the elaboration of pshat, drash, is when the midrashim see symbolic meanings going beyond the literal meaning. And the analogy would be, the Nitziv writes, poetry. The Torah itself is called a shira, a song, a poem, really. Moshe Rabbeinu, Hashem tells Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe Rabbeinu communicates to us, Kisvu lachem es hashira hazos. Write this song. And the whole Torah is called a song. The Nitziv writes, the reason the Torah is called a song, which really means a poem, it's not so much a musical, but a poem, like Shira Sayam, etc., is because in a poem, there may be a primary meaning, but the poet, by using unusual words, is trying to communicate secondary meanings. You see, when people sometimes say, oh, midrashic interpretations, God forbid, are far-fetched, they don't fit the words. Well, they don't have to fit the words totally, because they are extra meanings that Hashem put in by the use of something unusual, an extra hey, an extra vav, an unusual synonym. And Darash does not replace pshat. This is the meaning of the statement, ein mikra yotze midei pshuto, that a pasuk never escapes the pshat. The Darash is an extra level of depth and meaning, but it is not to the exclusion of pshat. Now, both pshat and Darash are still in the realm of the revealed Torah. They are not dealing with the ultimate secrets of the nature of God. So a drash might give us insight into Yosef and Yaakov and the Avos that you would not see from a surface perusal of the text, but it is still concerned with the earthly contents of the narrative. Right? Midrashim, the Midrashim that we have about the Avos, about the Imahos, about Matan Torah. Once we get to Remez and Sod, we are dealing with what are called the mysteries of the Torah. It's called the Pnimius of the Torah, the innermost meanings of the Torah. And Remez and Sod, Remez is simply kind of, Remez means hint or allusion. Remez is the outline of the deep secrets. Of the deep secrets of the Sod. And Sod is an outline. And Sod is the actual elaboration of the secrets itself. Now I'll give you an example. The Vilna Gaon himself, number one, refers to a lot of this in Mishlei. But if you take, for example, the Vilna Gaon's commentary on the book of Yonah, maybe some of you have seen this. So in the book of Yonah, you know, the pshat is we have a Navi who was given a mission that he didn't want to fulfill. And therefore a bunch of miracles happened to him that made him understand that number one, he cannot evade his responsibility to God, and number two, that Hashem is Malei Rachamim and Hashem accepts the tshuva even of the Umos HaOlam. That's the pshat of the story. And then we have Midrashim that elaborate what was it like in the fish and everything else. But in the Remez and the Sod, Yonah becomes a metaphor for the human soul that strives to come back to heaven, etc. And that the Remez is the outline of it, and the Sod goes into it in great depth. Yes, exactly right. Exactly right. Sod is Kabbalah. Sod is Kabbalah. And Remez, we would call, is the outline of Kabbalah. Kind of just the Remez. Remez to Kabbalah. By the way, just as a point of information, the Zohar, of course, is the main sefer of Kabbalah, but not everything in the Zohar qualifies as Sod. Around 50% of the Zohar is Drash. So it is actually a Medrash that one can learn like other Midrashim, and 50% is said to be Sod. The Ramban in his Perish was the first Mefarish who actually introduced Kabbalah into the explanation of the Psukim, and he has a buzzword when he says Al Derech HaEmes, the pathway of truth. That tells you that he's about to tell you something Kabbalistically. And here you should refer to the introduction of the Ramban, in which he says, whenever I start talking about Kabbalah, if you have not been initiated into this wisdom, you shall skip it. And he actually demands that we skip those things that he wrote into the commentary and the like. He says he wrote it for initiates, etc. So the Vilna Gaon says the following idea. Pshat, so these four callings is simply Hashem is saying, I've given you a Torah that is so filled with all of these levels of meaning. And he says the following. He says, going from the highest to the lowest. I'm sorry, lowest to the highest. Chutz is pshat. Because in a sense, chutz meaning outside, is a reference to pshat. Because chutz is the furthest from God, chutz, because you haven't penetrated the absolute inner meaning. And therefore he says, I guess, he describes the following, again, it's a complicated idea. He describes four types of communication based on voices. Listen to this. If I'm very, very far away from you, and I call out, I may be so far from you that all you hear is my echo. You don't hear my voice. The echo is called Rina. Rina means singing, but he's interpreting it to mean the reverberation of a voice. So that's called Rina. Now, the next level is when you hear my voice, but you don't hear what I'm saying. That is called titain kolah. So look at the words here. The first step is tarona. That is echo. The second step is titain kolah. You hear a voice, but you don't know what the voice says. The third Tikra. Tikra is you hear the person calling to you. Now, you don't make out the message yet, but you hear your name. Come here. You can hear that. I need to talk to you. And the last is Amoreha Somar. You actually hear the words. Do you see that these four descriptions of voice carry increasing levels of comprehension and understanding? Starting with hearing an echo, and then hearing a voice, then hearing that you're being called to something, and then hearing the statement. The Vilna Gaon says, this compares, metaphorically, to the four levels of understanding the Torah. When we have just pshat, and halvai we should have pshat, not demeaning pshat at all, but again, the Vilna Gaon is speaking, yeah, it's a little bit of an unfair comparison, the Vilna Gaon is speaking from the comparison of a person who mastered all four levels, so in retrospect, he's now describing pshat. So don't feel bad. He's basically saying, what is pshat? Pshat is I hear a faint echo of God's divine truth. I don't even hear the voice of God. I hear an echo of the voice of God. And then when there's drash, at least I hear a voice. And when there's remez, I hear the call of God speaking to me. And when there's sod, I hear the ultimate message of the Almighty. All of these different levels of Torah. Now, I do want to say, the Vilna Gaon says elsewhere, a very fascinating idea. He says, after you penetrate Sod, you then go back to Pshat, and you see how everything is in the simple meaning. Everything is in Pshat. That is why, at the end of the Vilna Gaon's life, it is said, He learned from the Sefer Torah, but we say Chumash. He only learned from the Sefer Torah. He didn't learn Gemara, didn't learn Zohar, didn't learn anything. He just had a Sefer Torah, and in the words of the Sefer Torah, the Pshat, he saw everything in the Pshat. So there is a point of closing the circle here, that on one hand, these are progressive levels, but on the other hand, you then turn back. By the way, the Arizal said the very same thing about davening. If you ever looked at a Kabbalistic siddur, a siddur that's based on the writings of the Ari, you will see pages and pages and pages of very, very deep and complicated meditations on every single word of the davening. When you say Baruch, here are like five pages. And five pages. It's not just pages. I mean, we wouldn't even understand three lines. I mean, so it's five pages where every word is beyond our comprehension. Sorry? Yeah. So a Kabbalistic Shemona Esrei, and there are people who daven Kabbalistic Shemona Esreis. In Yerushalayim, Baruch Hashem, we actually have yeshivas of Mekubalim, strangely enough, even in this day and age. A Kabbalistic Shemona Esrei could take 3 hours very easily. Not every, yeah, it can, it definitely can. But the Arizal once said that the purpose of all of these are called kavanos. Kavanos are these specific things that you think about. And these are not like, you know, Hashem, I want panasa. These are, you know, specifically ways of unifying the various spheres and the spheros. The Arizal said, the purpose of all of my meditations is that I should pray to Hashem like a two-year-old baby cries for his mother. That's all. We need the complexity just to achieve the simplicity. Because what happens is, in the course of growing up, so to speak, we become less spiritually sensitive, we become more removed from our feelings, we become distanced from that sense of dependence, and therefore we need complicated formulas to bring us back to that state. And therefore that's similar to what the Vilna Gaon is saying about Pshat, that you need the Sod to then go back into Pshat. And therefore he says that this is what Pasuk Beis is referring to, the four levels of Torah that bring a person to God and the like. You know, Rav Elyashiv's grandfather, was a very, very, very famous, perhaps the last of the greatest Mekubalim, Rav Shlomo Elyashiv. Maybe you've heard of him. He's called the Baal HaLeshem. He wrote a sefer, Leshem Shavo V'Achlama, which is available. It hasn't been translated. Rav Elyashiv was very, very close to his grandfather. And the grandfather, I think, died before Rav Elyashiv's bar mitzvah. But Rav Elyashiv actually helped him with the sefer. So in the sefer itself, this is a big Kabbalistic sefer, there are certain notes and observations by Yosef Shalom. No, 12-year-old boy, Yosef Shalom. So people would ask Rav Elyashiv, you know, do you know Kabbalah? I mean, he knew Kabbalah, but he didn't show it. So Rav Elyashiv says, no, I'm not a Mekubal. I'm not a Mekubal. I'm a Posek. I'm not a Mekubal. So when people would say, but your grandfather's Sefer is Kabbalah, and you wrote, so he would say, somewhat enigmatically, he says, I know now what I knew then. So it's not clear what he's saying. Okay. But be it as it may, what happened was that before the grandfather came to Eretz Yisrael, he was in Lithuania, in Lita, and many Gedolim would go to him for 6 months just to learn Kabbalah, like a crash course in Kabbalah. Rav Kook, for example, before Rav Kook came to Eretz Yisrael, Rav Kook went to the Leshem for 6 months to become initiated into Kabbalah. But they say there was one great Gadol who came to the Leshem to learn Kabbalah, but he couldn't stay because the Leshem had a rule. He says, because Kabbalah is a totally new way of looking at things, he said you weren't allowed to ask questions for 2 months. You just had to absorb, because you can't ask questions because it's a whole new system. So this Gadol said, I can't learn in an environment where I can't ask questions. So he didn't take advantage. But okay. But this is the idea of Sot. Okay. So, what is the call, right? Symbolically, there's this woman that is calling you. Look at the beautiful, multifaceted, infinite Torah. And what are those words? So here you'll notice, in the four levels of calling, there are three statements that are made. Right? So, three. Number one, Admasai Pisayim Tehavu Pesi. How long, now again, Pesi has a specific meaning, but now I'll just translate it very literally. How long will you foolish people love foolishness? Statement one. Statement two, V'leitzim Latzon Chamdu Lehem. And scoffers, how long will you desire Leitzanut? Scoffing. And number three, Kisilim. Again, foolish people, yisnu das, hate wisdom. So the Gra explains over here that there are three reasons why. Now again, keep in mind, we are not referring to Kasani right now. Kasani was the subject of the first mashal of people who want power, control, egotism, domination. This part of the Perek is dealing with the second Yetzer Hara. And the second Yetzer Hara is called Tavani. Tavani means a lust for pleasure and hedonism. So we're not talking about the egotistical, angry person who needs to control and dominate. We're talking about the lazy person who wants to engage in self-indulgence. So within that category, again, we're all a mixture of both, but we're isolating just to create archetypes. Within this Tavani personality, there are three sibot, three reasons, why a person will distance himself from the beckoning call of the Torah. The first is they want a life of self-indulgence and ease. They want to enjoy the tavot of the world, the pleasures of the world, and therefore they do not want to devote themselves to spirituality. Now, that is referred to as the Pesi. Again, in English, the Pesi will be described as a fool, but if you remember, I think I mentioned last week, that Pesi comes from the word enticement. Noach lehispatot. They are very easily persuaded to follow the prevailing fads. Right? It's been well said that Madison Avenue, what is the goal of advertising? To convert a desire into a need. Well, number one, give you desires that you otherwise didn't have. And after you have the desire, convince you that it's something you have to have. Even though, you know, the day before, you didn't even think, you know, you didn't, weren't even aware of it, and the like. So that's called a pessi. A pessi is someone who is easily enticed and easily persuaded to go after the latest fad, because they think it'll give them comfort or pleasure. So that is the first mapala. Ad masai, how long will you, the pessi, love, as it were, to be enticed and persuaded into every type of fad? That is the first mapala, the first downfall of the tavani. Now the second, the Vilna Gaon says, and here he has a very interesting point. The Chafetz Chaim actually quotes this next section in the Shmiras HaLashon, in his book on Lashon Hara, because the Gra says an interesting thing. He says that another reason why people are marchik from the Torah, they don't want to sit and learn Torah, is because they would prefer to use their speech on other matters. They have a tremendous desire to shmooze, to converse, to say Lashon Hara. Leitzanus is to make fun of things. And therefore, you know, you can't do two things with your mouth at the same time. If your mouth and your mind is involved in Lashon Hara, Leitzanus, you're not going to be free to learn. Now the Gra makes the point that he differentiates between what's called tava and chemda. Tava are sensual pleasures that give you direct physical pleasure. Eating, drinking, sexual relations, and the like. Chemda is that which might give you psychological pleasure, even though there's no physical pleasure itself, such as Lashon Hara. And he said, or Leitzanus. Leitzanus is really, you might call, institutionalized Lashon Hara. Leitzanus is overall cynicism and scoffing. So every time somebody does something, you put it down, etc. That is called Leitzanus. Leitzanus. Leitzanus was taken very seriously. I'll tell you a story about Rebbe Akiva Eiger. And in truth, I find the story difficult to fully understand, but I'll tell you the story anyway. Rebbe Akiva Eiger was the greatest, there was the Gadol Hador. And he was also very meforsam for his humility as well, his modesty. And when a shidduch was made with his oldest son, so he went over to the mechutin, and he said, "I hope the shidduch finds favor in your eyes. I hope my son is a good chassan for your daughter." So the man replied with a joke, which I guess in retrospect was in bad taste, but it had devastating consequences. He said, "Halvai that the mechutin should be as good as the son," meaning I love the son so much. Again, I don't think the joke played too well. But because Rabbi Akiva Eiger was such a tzaddik, Rabbi Akiva Eiger was very concerned that he had done something to hurt the mechutin. And he said, "If I hurt you in any way, please, please tell me. I could ask mechila and make up to you." So the mechutin was horrified. He says, No, I was just making a joke. I was saying that your son is so great." Rabbi Akiva Eiger says, "Leitzanus! You're doing Leitzanus!" He broke off the shidduch. He broke up the shidduch because he considered that to be Leitzanus. Okay, it's a little bit of a difficult story, but it shows you how serious Great Gedolim took Leitzanus. So Leitzanus is called chemda and not taiva, because Leitzanus is not really a pleasure, but he says the Yetzirah is phenomenal. And the reason is, the Vilna Gaon says, everything that you do, whether it's a mitzvah or an aveira, and this is what the Chafetz Chaim brings, Hashem gives you a ruach, a spirit, milmala, that will urge you to do more of that. That's the inner meaning of mitzvah, gereris mitzvah. When I do a mitzvah, I get a spirit in me that gives me a desire to do more. When I do an aveira, I get a spirit in me with a desire to do more. And the more holy the mitzvah, the greater the spirit is, and the worse the aveira, the stronger the negative spirit is. And since Lashon Hara is such a chomer aveira, the spirit and the desire to engage in it after the first mistake is a more powerful Yetzer Hara. This is what the Chafetz Chaim brings and the like. And it's precisely, meaning the stronger the Yetzer Hara, that's the simon, that it's a more powerful Aver. And in fact, the phrase, Nachas Ruach, let's analyze this a little bit. We talk about a person getting Nachas. But Nachas is actually a contraction. The complete phrase is, you should have Nachas Ruach. The translation of nachas, nachas in Aramaic means to subside, to lower, to rest. It's connected to menucha. When a person is not benachas ruach, they are agitated and anxious. Their spirit is jumping around. Nachas ruach is when the spirit is rested. So in this sense, when I do a big aveira, and there's a ruach in me that pushes me to do it again, I'm not going to have nachas ruach until I do it again. Strangely enough. So, therefore, the pasuk says, again, you'll see why he brings this in. He brings this in really to the next thing. So how long will the hedonist be enticed by Madison Avenue? How long will the lates, the scoffer and the cynic, desire, chomed, that which doesn't even give him physical pleasure? That's the second one. Now the third one is the ksil. Now you'll recall, I think I mentioned this, that although in English, this is why the English translations are not as good as we would hope. Ksil is translated as fool. But if you recall, I think I mentioned to you, that kisil is actually related to overconfidence. And the third problem that the Baal Taiva has is that the Baal Taiva does not enjoy Torah because he wants instant gratification. And something that you have to work for does not give him pleasure because it is not instant. So he hates the process of das, because it's hard, and I don't want something hard. By the way, this is actually a problem. I mean, I actually have encountered this the problem. Sometimes there are exceptionally bright people who don't have to work to understand a lot of things, but then they get hit with something that they have to work for. And literally, they may never have had that skill. They may have gone through elementary school and high school, sometimes even college. And then they may come to yeshiva, they get hit with Gemara, or even no graduate. I mean, this happens in the secular world as well. It is a skill to be able to work on something. And sometimes very bright people might be bedafka prone to the idea that I didn't have to work. And therefore the Gra says, this third group, they are not margish, the mesikos haTorah. They do not feel the sweetness of Torah because they don't want to work. Right, so these are the three sibos in this pasuk. Why b'nei Adam are marchiken es atzman min haTorah? Number one, they love physical pleasure. Number two, they have a chemda or a chamida for leitzanus. And number three, they don't want to work, and therefore they're not margish. So therefore, the next pasuk is also a threefold response. Again, the way the Gra learns, if pasuk chaf beis is an ABC listening, pasuk chaf gimel will be an ABC response. See, that's how he often does it. You have to match up. So he says, with respect to the criticism, when will the Pesi, or how long will the Pesi continue to love enticement? What he should be doing is, Tashuvu letochachti. Listen, or return, to my tochacha. Now, tochacha is chastisement, musr. Meaning, listen to someone, to a teacher, telling you what life is about, what the purpose of life is. Tashuvu, tochacha. And this specifically means, the Vilna Gaon says, things like remembering the day of death, knowing we're not going to live forever, knowing that all of the material pleasures are not going to last and it's only the spiritual mitzvot that will count. All of that is tokacha. So tokacha, properly given, you have to know how to give it, and we'll talk about that a lot too, but if properly given and absorbed, is the antidote to the pesi, to the hedonism. Now, the lates, this is where the lates, right, find it's very hard to break away because the lates has a ruach mimaron. Right, the more I speak Oshner, the more the ruach comes that gives me such a desire that I don't have nachas ruach until I stop. So what can I tell that person? Abia lachem ruchi. If you turn your desire to do good things, I will give you a ruach. Meaning, don't think, in other words, this is an achama to a person. Don't think you will be living with this addiction forever. Because the same way the aveira gives you a ruach that pushes you to do the aveira, if you turn to the Torah, you will also get a ruach that will push you to learn the Torah. You see, this is a very important message. Because if a person would be told that your entire life you're going to have to struggle with this tremendous, tremendous yetzer hara, whether it's lashon hara, whatever it is, then a person would just give up and say, I can't manage that. But Hashem's promise is you'll get a counter ruach that will lift you up. That's why it says ruchi. And the third thing, that I don't want to work for Torah, I just want it to come to me. Hashem says no. Odia devarai etchem. You will get das, meaning yagatu matzasa. If you put in the effort, you will get the insight. You will feel the sweetness of Torah. You know, the Chazon Ish writes, and I have to admit, I have not done this experimentally, and I wish I would be able to. He says that if a person were to learn Torah 10 hours straight without interruption, without any interruption, 10 hours straight, he said there would be an unbelievable sense of closeness to Hashem. And he graphically talks about it. He says, most people, even if they're learning the whole day, I mean, almost nobody goes even an hour and a half without some interruption. Some interruption might be small. But the Chazon Ish says, that's like bringing a pot of water to boil. Let's imagine, it's a very nice muscle. Let's imagine it takes 20 minutes to bring a pot of water to boil. But after 19 and a half minutes, you shut off the water, shut off the pot, or shut off the gas, and the pot cools down. No matter how many times you heat it 19 and a half minutes, it's never going to boil because you don't have that critical momentum. And he made a point that spiritually, there is a certain momentum and critical mass. This is what the Mefarshim say with Rabbi Akiva. People ask the Kasha, again, this may not be a totally satisfactory answer. Remember, Rabbi Akiva was an Am Haaretz, he was an ignorant person. He married Rachel, very wealthy family. The father was so angry that she married an ignorant man that he excommunicated and disinherited his daughter. So she lived in poverty. But she sent Rabbi Akiva, who was 40 years old, to learn in yeshiva, and he started with the first graders, learning how to read. And he was there for 12 years. And he came back to pay her a visit, and he overhears her having a conversation with a neighbor in the kitchen, where the neighbor says, what type of husband do you have that leaves you for 12 years? And she said, I wouldn't mind if he'd go for another 12 years. This was understood positively. And Rabbi Akiva turned around and went back for another 12 years, after which he came back with 24,000 Talmidim. Of course, unfortunately, the story has a tragic ending because those are the ones that died during the Omer. But putting that aside, he couldn't say hello. He couldn't have a cup of coffee and then go back. He just turns around without even coming in. So there are two answers the Mefarshim give. One answer is that we don't really understand this, but 24 is not the same as 2 times 12. If he would have interrupted, somehow the momentum would have been lost. There's a cumulative momentum. Otherwise it would have been 19.5 and 19.5. This way it was 24. The second answer is a very interesting psychological answer. Rabbi Akiva felt in the depths of his heart the sacrifice that his wife made and how much she suffered. If he would have allowed himself to come into the kitchen, he wouldn't have left. He couldn't have left. He had to make the decision right then. Because if he would have allowed himself to open up his feelings, he could not have moved from that point. So he made what undoubtedly was a very, very difficult decision. Okay, you have a good week. I'm sorry. Yes, he did. He did. He did. He did. In fact, there's a very interesting story. He had a daughter, and the daughter married a man, and they got divorced. And it seems part of why they got divorced is because he also wanted to do what Rabbi Akiva did, and she didn't want it. So she saw what her mother went through. Yeah. Okay, thank you. Thanks. Thank you. Did you see the letter?